Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Mirror, mirror on the wall. Tell me, mirror, what is wrong? Can it be my daylight clothes or is it just my daylight soul? What I do ain't make believe. People say I sit and try, but when it comes to being daylight, it's just me, myself, and I.
The album was called 3 Feet High and Rising, but it towered over hip-hop. Now, it's in the Library of Congress. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today, the story of a game-changing debut album from the band De La Soul. Later, Moroccan-born singer Malika Zahra is reshaping the sound of American jazz with North African rhythms and lyrics in Arabic and French. She and her band will play live. Plus, the Philadelphia Orchestra, headed to bankruptcy court. But we'll pick up where we left off last week to begin. In our discussion of the Library of Congress and the 25 recordings it recently designated for official preservation, among them was this album, 3 Feet High and Rising, the debut album released in 1989 by the Long Island-based hip-hop group De La Soul. The library noted that the album was, quote, upbeat and humorous, and bucked hip-hop's increasing turn towards stark urban naturalism in the late 1980s. Well, that's all very well and good, but we want to dig a little deeper, so I'm joined in the studio today by Dan Charnas, author of the book The Big Payback, The History of the Business of Hip-Hop. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you.
And also with me is Von P, rapper and producer with the Brooklyn-based rap group Tanya Morgan. Von, good to see you again.
Happy to be back.
Guys, the Library of Congress announcement is meant to ensure that this record and the other 24 that they chose last year will always be available to the American public. Now, that's a nice thing. Dan, why? Why this record? Why is it so important?
I think 3 Feet High and Rising, and which was the debut of De La Soul, represented a turning point in hip-hop. You have to understand what came before it. Hip-hop was from the streets. It had made its way onto record. But most of the hip-hop that was on record was pretty much without artifice. It presented itself the way it did in the streets. What De La Soul did with their debut was to bring a bit of the bohemian, a sense of artifice to hip-hop. And in really what they did was they invented a new language that had never been expressed before and was open to interpretation.
I want to follow up on the artifice thing, because that's, I mean, we think of artificial as a bad thing.
Right.
You know, and authenticity, keeping it real, has been such an important part of hip-hop. Why would artifice be, like, such a positive thing?
Well, artifice is related to the word art. And the fact is that there are different ways to make art. You can depict a world and reflect the culture of the streets, or you can dream a new one. Mm-hmm. And I think what De La Soul did and what 3 Feet High and Rising did as a work of art is to show that hip-hop could actually dream a whole new world. You know, the arrival of 3 Feet High and Rising, the album actually arrived packaged in flowers. And so in
right,
some way,
yeah,
you can look at it in the same way that when the arrival of flowers happened in rock and roll, it was the same thing. It was people who started to invent their own language, a language that was open to interpretation, a language that promised more than she loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So this is the Sgt. Pepper of hip-hop.
That's right.
Von, do you agree?
Yeah, I would say, you know, to further on what he said, it brought forth a voice that wasn't a part of hip-hop yet, where you had, like, the nerds in high school.
Mm-hmm.
This is what they did, and now it was on an album. You never had that before in hip-hop, and that's what this album did. It speaks to a whole community of people that weren't being spoken to, at least in hip-hop.
Well, now, that was back in 1989.
Yeah.
You and the rest of the band, Tanya Morgan, you guys, that's not your generation.
I was seven. But, like I was telling Dan outside, everyone in my family, I'm the only child in my family that was born in the 80s. Everybody else is 70s and earlier, or, you know, kids now.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to watch my older cousins and older brother and parents and what they were into, and the music they liked didn't necessarily reflect in De La Soul. And I was the kid that liked this corny group. But that spoke to who I was as a person, and
well,
I was amongst those people.
Now, here's the thing. That's a long time ago. Does it still speak to you know, you talked about, you know, a generation in your family mm-hmm. who are now kids. Are they listening to this? To this record?
I have a younger brother that, if not for me, I don't think he would be into it. He's more like, you know, wants to be like the Neptunes and Kanye and, you know, mm-hmm. wants to dress like them and all of that stuff. But he knows De La Soul, and I was telling him about the Tribe movie coming soon. And he was like, oh, man, I want to see that. And I had no clue. But, you know, because of, I guess, my influence, he's into it. But I'm still the loner in that.
Well, the big thing about this album, the big story behind this album when it first came out, Dan, mm-hmm. aside, of course, from the fact that it had some really great music on it, was the whole sampling thing.
Right.
I mean, it's like Disneyland for you can just sit there, and no matter how much you think you know about music, there'll be something you didn't pick out the first time or the 20th time through. Mm-hmm. How remarkable was this? I mean, was it really the first record to do that sort of thing, or was it just, again, a kind of a turning point?
De La, I think, took it to sampling, the art of sampling, which was a nascent art back then, to its sort of ultimate conclusion. And I say that, you know, whatever, you know, 20 years later almost, mm-hmm. or over 20 years later, I don't think that an album since then has been that insane. with sampling, and part of that is for legal reasons, which I guess we'll talk about.
Right.
But another thing is just that they were kids, unsupervised, left alone to do what they wanted to do. And again, with you know, the inventing the new language, they also came irony. Mm-hmm. A lot of what they did was ironic, sort of looking at all these little pieces and snatches of hip-hop and country music and rock and roll and putting them all together in a way with a little bit of a wink.
Mm-hmm. So just to give you an idea of what we're talking about, here is about 60 seconds worth of De La Soul. See how many individual tracks of music you can pick out in the magic number.
But it just won't go away. Three times one.
What is it?
One, two, three.
That's a magic number.
Yo, what's up?
One, two, three.
That is just a little bit from The Magic Number from De La Soul's 1989 debut, 3 Feet High and Rising. Let me give you just a partial list of what you just heard. Clips from Bob DeRoe's Schoolhouse Rock song, Three is a Magic Number. Little bit of Double D and Steinsky, early pioneers in the art of sampling before things were cleared. Led Zeppelin, James Brown, Eddie Murphy, Johnny Cash, Fiorello LaGuardia, recorded on WNYC. Yes, you, Dan sitting here with his jaw agape.
Which one?
Where he's reading the funnies.
Oh, my
That God. Is, it's just, you know, that's actually, I think, used twice on this record. Anyway, these things are just like buried in the mix. And here's where we get into the whole legal story behind this record. Dan, they were very, very careful about getting permission and clearing all of these hundreds of tiny samples that they used, except for one.
I don't actually know that that's true, though.
Well, that's what Steinsky of Double D and Steinsky told us years ago.
Because, you know, Tom Silverman said that as well, that they cleared something somewhere between 30 and 60 samples. But, you know, there was no way they could have afforded all of that. And
back in 1989, you know, would people have known to say, well, yes, you can use my sample, but it's going to cost you $10,000?
Listen, it was a more of a new thing at the time. So it wasn't, you know, at the time, hip hop still hadn't gone to like the P. Diddy levels, MC Hammer levels yet.
Right.
So people were like, okay, let these guys, you know, they can just give me $100 or something. But then I would say between De La Soul and the Bismarck Key case, it went overboard.
Right. That mm-hmm. So it was a real landmark. But Dan, what's the story as you know it?
Well, what happened was that, you know, whether they cleared or not, there was one sample that they didn't clear, and that was for one of their songs called Transmitting Live from Mars, and it was a sample of The Turtles, You Showed Me. And Flo and Eddie from The Turtles heard the song. I think one of their daughters had the song or something like that, and they filed suit. And it was very it was probably the first very public suit mm-hmm. against a record company that distributed hip-hop. There had been suits before. Jimmy Castor sued Def Jam over the use of one of his records in the Beastie Boys record. But like everything else that had come before it, this suit was settled out of court. But it was very, very public, and it scared a lot of Tom Silverman's contemporaries, Tom Silverman being the president and founder of Tommy Boy Records, which put out 3 Feet High and Rising. So some of the indie record companies that really had a hold on the hip-hop industry then started to pay more attention to clearing samples, but it wasn't until, as Vaughn P. mentioned, I Need a Haircut, which yeah. was Bismarcky had replayed Alone Again. And
beatboxed it.
Right. Gilbert O'Sullivan didn't like that. Mm-hmm. And because of some, I believe, negligence on the part of both Cole Chillen and Warner Brothers attorneys, it actually made it before a judge, and that's something that nobody wanted to have happen, because there's no guarantee that a judge is going to understand what postmodern music making is. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's hear the original song from The Turtles called You Showed Me, and then we'll hear how it reappears in this album we're talking about from De La Soul.
You showed me how to do exactly what you do, how I fell in love with you.
Now, it may not be so easy, but you'll hear the same music looped and backwards in the album by De La Soul.
Quelle heure est-il?
Il est midi.
C'est l'heure de déjeuner.
Qu'est-ce qu'il y a à manger?
Des saucisses. Sans doute.
Écoutez et répétez. À midi. À midi. À midi.
Quelle heure est-il? Quelle heure? Quelle heure?
Transmitting Live from Mars is the name of that little clip from De La Soul from the album 3 Feet High and Rising, which opened up a Pandora's box, as Dan Charnas has been telling us. He's author of The Big Payback, The History of the Business of Hip-Hop. He's also managing editor of Interactive One. Vaughn P., producer and rapper with the Brooklyn-based group Tanya Morgan's also with us, and has a solo CD called P's Gotta Have It. Dan, pick up the thread here.
Well, another sample, the sample that was laid over that the French sample, is mm-hmm. actually from a Scott Forsman high school French audio, the audio lab.
Right, right.
Another interesting thing is at the time I was actually working at Profile Records, and what we would do at the time, since Flo and Eddie from the Turtles had a radio show in New York on, I think it was the Classic Rock station, we would call them and request Transmitting Live from Mars, you know, pretty regularly.
So this piece of this little snippet of music, you know, it's disguised, but it's in there. Mm-hmm. Flo and Eddie heard it, recognized something of their own. And as you say, it was settled out of court. But really, what was the, you know, I mean, we're still feeling the echoes of that 20 years on, aren't
yes.
we?
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, listen, De La Soul wasn't the first to aggressively sample. I think, you know, the credit has to be given to Public Enemy and the Bomb Squad for doing Pardon?
I'm sorry. Paul's Boutique as well. The
yeah.
Beastie Boys.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it was postmodern music making. It was sonic collage, and De La took it really to its ultimate conclusion, or rather just showed us what the possibilities were.
Right.
But after the Turtles case, and then after, obviously, Bismarcky and the Judge Duffy ruling and that, sampling became very expensive, We lost a lot of what came to us, what was bequeathed to us from the Bronx,
right.
which was this sense that there's a canon of music that I can, you know, mix and match and put together and create something new. Mm-hmm. And that's always been, to me, key in hip-hop. And, you know, we lost a lot of that after that.
Von P from the band Tiny Morgan, whether you're with the band or doing your solo thing, I mean, you came of age as a musician after these cases that Dan's been talking about. So your approach to sampling must have been very different from, you know, the early Grandmaster Flash and all those guys.
Really, what we do, if anything, is we'll use one a record. The rule for us is if there's one sample, stop there, because you don't want to start adding more, and then there's not even a percentage, because now a lot of times it's 100%, as far as I believe, 100% of publishing, and you can't go past 100%. So, like, there was a case of Jay-Z's song, Show Me What You Got, was like 125 or something like that, and nobody made any money off of it. Stuff like that, you know.
Well, we're talking about the historic album, the debut album by De La Soul called 3 Feet High and Rising. We're talking about it now, all these years later, because last week the Library of Congress announced that it was one of the 25 recordings it had designated for official preservation. And Vaughn, when we asked you about it, you suggested that we play this track called Take It Off.
Why?
Why?
I feel like, you know, when you're in high school, I always take this back to them being young, and they were, I believe, 16 to 18 when they made this album. And the type of high schooler they spoke to was the kids that were over here watching the other kids wearing, you know, whatever was the style. I was 7, so I don't know what was hip.
Right. But the Jordache jeans.
Yeah,
Jordache and
all that. And they were the other kids that thought that wasn't cool. And this was the first time you ever heard that in song, in a hip-hop song. And now you have people that do it all the time, like, oh, we're not going to wear throwback jerseys anymore. It's not cool anymore. But De La pioneered that with this skit.
This is called Take It Off from 3 Feet High and Rising.
Take it off, off, off. Take that BVD off.
Take it off, off, off. Take those Converse off. Take it off, off, off.
And the Gazelles too.
Take it off, off, off. Take that Kango off.
Take it off, off, off.
Take that Jordache off.
Take it off, off. Take that Afro off. Take it off, off.
Take that Jerry Curl off.
Take it off. Take it off, off.
Take those acid wash jeans, bell bottom, designed by your mama. Off, please, please, please.
That is Take It Off, De La Soul from their album 3 Feet High and Rising. Dan Charnas was talking before about irony, and Von P telling us about how this was really the first time you heard this sort of calling out against consumerism, conspicuous consumption, and stuff like that. There's another thread, Vaughn, that sort of weaves throughout this record, and that is the skit.
The skit.
Was this really the first big use of the skit on a hip-hop record?
I believe they say the first skit was a Stevie Wonder song. I don't remember what song it was. But, yeah, this was the first time there were skits throughout an album, and every song wasn't song, 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 song. And that goes to them all being friends, and, you know, the three MCs growing up with one another, then meeting Prince Paul and having this time to bug out in the studio, recording it and putting it on an album.
All right, now, you mentioned Prince Paul. I mean, you're a producer as well as a rapper.
Love Prince Paul, yeah.
So is he the man for hip-hop production for you?
Yeah, for sure. Because with Prince Paul, it wasn't so much about the beat as much as it was about the idea and what he was doing around the beat. It always sounded like you were at like a fair or something when it was one of his beats, and I love that about him.
Dan, what about the skit and the production, you know, apart from the sampling, just the way this record is put together? You know, you've got this kind of goofy TV game show thing, and you keep coming back to it throughout the course. I mean, The architecture of this album is really different.
Right, and it has a lot to do with the freedom that Prince Paul and the three guys in De La Soul had in the studio. It was a very fun environment, and they were encouraged by people like Dante Ross, who was the production supervisor, and Monica Lynch, who was the president of Tommy Boy, to just keep going. And what's so amazing about this record is that they're short songs. And remember, rap originated in these long 15-minute grooves, like disco grooves, and they broke it down to like 30 seconds, 1 minute, 2 minute, out. Right. And you know, they say also it increased the perceived value of the album because you had something like, I don't know, 30, 40 tracks on the I never counted. But
27, it's, I believe.
There you go.
There's so, somebody who's counted.
Right. Yeah, so it was a big part of that. And, of course, I have to mention that the other, the flip side to the sonic part of the record is the packaging and the marketing of it, which very, very adventurous, very important, and in some ways influenced a lot by the people at Tommy Boy who were actually fans, believe it or not, of Roxy Music. Mm-hmm. And they loved how Roxy Music had its sort of own, not only its own visual vocabulary, they were a concept band. And so they transferred that love of that in the alternative space to hip hop. So it was really a great marriage. It could have only happened on Tommy Boy Records, really, the way it did.
And with all the flowers and stuff, I mean, there was like a conscious... Von P, I mean, did you get the hippie vibe from that, even though you were too young to have lived through the...
I definitely did. I, like the rest of the people, when it first came out, I was like, oh, this is kind of like, you know, the hippies, rock and roll, 70s stuff. Yeah. At that young age, I saw the cover and said, oh, this is like, you know, Jimi Hendrix and that
right.
stuff. So.
the album called 3 Feet High and Rising, 1989 debut from the Long Island trio known as De La Soul, and now it is in the Library of Congress, part of the National Recording Registry, 25 recordings each year designated for official preservation. This is one of them, and we've been remembering the record with Dan Charnas, author of the book The Big Payback, The History of the Business of Hip-Hop, and Von P, the rapper and producer with the Brooklyn-based rap group Tanya Morgan. Guys, great to see the two of you again. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
From that album by De La Soul, this is I Know.
Stay with me, I know this, but not because of all my earthly treasures or regardless to the fact that I'm past the noose, but because
I know I love you, yeah.
I cut this dance to introduce myself as the chosen one to speak. Let me lay my hand across yours and aim a kiss upon your cheek. The name's
Plunk 2. That's called I Know from De La Soul. You might, if you were listening carefully, you might have heard a little bit of Peg from the album Asia by Steely Dan, another of this year's inductees into the Library of Congress, and the subject of our Soundcheck Smackdown debate on tomorrow's program. Still to come on this program, the first of the nation's Big Five orchestras, the Philadelphia Orchestra, heads to bankruptcy court. And coming up next, Morocco's jazz jewel, as CNN describes her, Malika Zahra, sings a blend of new urban world jazz live in our studio.